system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want. We want, 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 we want to liberate and land. Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians. Cause they owned by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain. But my people getting tired of the pain.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips with guest co-host Marty Bennett. Mickey Huff will be back next week. On today's program, we look at the Fight for the 15 campaign, the growing movement for a $15 an hour minimum wage. We'll be joined by Paul Son with the National Employment Law Project and a panel of guests from around Northern California, where a variety of minimum wage campaigns and living wage efforts are underway.
Created by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, filled with capacity citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love, we flipped our brothers and our sisters.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. Today we're really going to address the significance of what a $15 an hour wage would do to workers in the United States. This is a national campaign called the Fight for the 15. Our guests are mostly local people here in the Bay Area that are engaged in different activities. I want to first introduce Marty Bennett as our co-host today. He's taught American and California history at Santa Rosa Junior College for 25 years, and he's co-chair of the North Bay Jobs for Justice, also a research and policy analyst for Unite Here 2850, the union representing restaurants, hotels, and food service workers in the North and East Bay. He writes regularly for the newspapers up in our area. Marty, thank you so much for coming in.
It's great to be here, Peter.
And also in studio with us today is Jamise Myers. She lives and works in the city of Oakland. She's a senior research and policy associate at EBASE, East Bay Alliance for Sustainable Economy, working in coalition with community labor and faith groups to raise the floor for low-wage workers. And she's brought a guest with us as well. His name is John Jones. He's a member of the Lift Up Oakland campaign. He was born and raised in Oakland, now works as a security guard in one of the major fast food chains. So we'll be hearing from him in a little bit. Marty, you want to introduce our first guest who's going to be on the line with us?
Our first guest on this show is Paul Son. And he's general counsel and program director for the National Employment Law Project in New York. And for 15 years, Paul has worked on new approaches for promoting living wage jobs. He's authored numerous reports and provided expert testimony on proposed living wage laws and increases in the state minimum wage. Paul?
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me on.
Great to have you here. And let's start off talking about Seattle and begin with a living wage ordinance passed in SeaTac, a small city in the Seattle metropolitan region, last fall. Could you talk about that and what occurred there?
It was a ballot initiative campaign for a $15 wage ordinance covering workers at the SeaTac, that's the Seattle Airport, and some of the surrounding hospitality industry and transportation jobs in the city. And it really was the first campaign that was sort of to try to implement on the ground the $15 minimum wage demand that's really been popularized by the fast food strikers nationwide, who have really expanded the range of the possible and what low-wage workers are fighting for in wage justice campaigns. And SeaTac was really the first place where one of these proposals was put before voters and was enacted. In some ways, it wasn't revolutionary because there are a bunch of the West Coast airports already had similar wage laws. Some of them were almost as high. That was SFO Airport, the San Jose Airport, the LAX Airport, and Oakland all have had higher wages for a long time. But SeaTac was really kind of driven off of the fast food campaign's energy, and it helped really build momentum for the so-called Fight for 15, which is this big push for real substantially higher minimum wages that we're seeing across the country.
The SeaTac living wage law that narrowly passed at the ballot box has been tied up in court. But talk about the spillover between what happened at SeaTac and then the city of Seattle approving a $15 an hour citywide minimum wage.
The same election where the voters approved the SeaTac $15 wage brought Mayor Ed Murray in Seattle to office on a platform that included bringing a $15 minimum wage to that very high-cost city. And so he then convened a working group of businesses and local residents and labor and other stakeholders that during the spring hammered out a proposal that had the support of a substantial share of the business community as well as labor and the city council, which was implemented to phase up a $15 minimum wage for that city. With that really built off of SeaTac, and it's the first city in the United States to agree to phase up to a $15 minimum wage. And I think part of what's significant about this movement is many of the kind of past minimum wage campaigns have just been seeking to restore the minimum wage to its historic level to make up for the value that's been lost to inflation over the last few decades. And even the highest minimum wages in the country, like San Francisco's, were only basically at the level where the minimum wage would have been if it had kept pace with inflation. Seattle and this new generation of policies pushing to phase the minimum wage up to 15 really represents the first real gain in the minimum wage that we've seen in decades. It will bring the minimum wage up to a higher level than it's been at in the United States and really raise pay broadly across the bottom of the economy. And part of why that's so crucial is that's where most of the new job growth is in the economy. Since the recession, somewhere between 45 and 60% of the new jobs generated have been in low-paying fields. And so it's where more and more working Americans are spending their careers.
Paul, this is Peter Phillips. Paul Sohn is the Program Director, National Employment Law Project. And we're here today talking about the Fight for 15 campaign. And is that part of your vision, to have everybody in the U.S. who's working at least be paid $15 an hour?
But, you know, long-term, you know, absolutely. We think the U.S. really, the U.S. economy needs a substantially higher minimum wage. The fast-growing jobs are jobs in restaurants, retail, home health care. These are the non-offshoreable service jobs, many of them vital services that our communities and economy depend on. And it's just bad for families and bad for our economy to have so many people earning low wages. There was actually a headline in the Wall Street Journal last week saying that investors and analysts are really worried that slow wage growth is one of the key factors holding back the economy. The American consumers just don't have the money to spend that businesses need in order to grow and hire more staff. So higher wages are both good on a macro level for the economy and crucial for families. And so, you know, it's not something you can do overnight. Obviously, the minimum wage, it's been allowed to erode so low that if you're going to raise it to a more robust level like 15, it really has to be phased in a deliberate, paced-in way. And that's exactly what Seattle did. And if you're doing it for lower-cost parts of the country, you would want to phase it in, you know, even more gradually. But, you know, long-term, that's where we need our wage floor to go to, you know, for the health of the economy and working families.
Clearly, the numbers on this are stunning, and if the federal minimum, $7.25 an hour, had just been adjusted for inflation since the late 60s, it would be over $10.60 an hour today. Had it been adjusted for productivity, it would be over $22 an hour today. So Tell us, Paul, is Seattle a model for other cities? And what's the relationship between many citywide minimum wage and living wage campaigns and the impact on state minimum wage?
Great question. Yeah, no, absolutely. Seattle is clearly, it's sort of a model for other, especially the high-cost cities. We're seeing that the high-cost global cities, are there's a new wave of action to raise them to levels of, you know, 15 or close to it. So, you know, San Francisco, there's already a labor and chamber of commerce supported consensus proposal to go to the voters to make that city the next $15 minimum wage city. There are proposals in LA and Chicago and in New York City. Advocates have been fighting for $15 minimum wage. They need authorization from the governor to raise the city minimum wage, and Governor Andrew Cuomo has backed a $13 minimum wage for the city. So they're hopeful that that will be won in the next 6 months or so. So there's clearly a huge wave of action, especially for high-cost cities. And some of the other smaller cities, especially in your area, are also proposing local minimum wages, generally at a somewhat lower level, as may make sense for their economies. And your next guest from eBase in Oakland is, you know, they're the leaders in one of those campaigns. There's this wave of action by cities. It's clearly having an effect on the state campaigns. The fast food strikers in Seattle and this movement are really expanding the level to where everyone's seeking to push the minimum wage. And so at the state level, we're seeing more action in the $11 to $13 an hour range. Massachusetts has just raised its minimum wage to $11 an hour. The California Senate approved a $13 minimum wage bill, and you know that's going to go to the Assembly during the summer. So at the state level as well, there's been this spillover effect, and we're seeing much more ambitious proposals, which will, if adopted, raise wages much more broadly than has been the case in the past.
Paul, I'd really like you to make the point here that you're applying this, how raising the minimum wage has a positive effect on the economy. And we know that for decades now, the top 10%, the top 1% have massively increased their income. And the rest of us literally have gone down and declined. And that hurts the economy because we don't have as much to spend. And so how does increasing the minimum wage across the country improve the economy overall?
It's very straightforward. It's that when middle and working class people have higher wages, they spend it on necessities, and it gets circulated through the local economy. They'll, you know, it raises sales at local restaurants and food stores and gas stations, and producing the income and profits that business need to take on more staff and hire and continue, you know, growing the economy. Whereas when more and more income is skewed towards the very affluent, they save it and invest. They save the bulk of it. Nick Hanauer, who's a venture capitalist up in Seattle, says that wealthy as he is, he only needs one pair of shoes at a time, one pillow when he sleeps. Wealthy people, their spending is not in proportion to their higher income. It really is raising wages broadly for the masses that has the largest effect on boosting consumer demand in the economy.
Well, Paul, thanks very much for joining us from New York. You're very engaged back there, and we certainly appreciate hearing you. We're out of time on this segment because we want to get to go on what's going on here in Oakland. But thank you so much for being on.
Thanks so much.
Up next, we have Jamise Myers and John Jones. They're both from Oakland. Jamise lives and works at the city of Oakland. She's a senior research and policy analyst at eBase, the East Bay Alliance for Sustainable Economy. And her guest with us today is John Jones, who's a member of Lift Up Oakland Campaign and born and raised here in Oakland. And you work as a security guard in a local fast food, shall we name it, the Burger King?
Yes.
Jamise, tell us what's been going on here in Oakland.
Well, thanks for having us today, Peter and Marty. Let's get started talking about the policy and how we came to this policy and who's involved. And John, why don't you just kick it off?
Okay, sure. First of all, as far as the policy goes, the provisions are the wage is $12.25 an hour. And that number came about as a result of understanding that that yearly adds up to $25K. And that's a number that we need to realize because that is just a start. Right. I mean, that is not the end all be all. We're talking about a situation where there are many people in the city of Oakland. For example, the workers here, 25 to 30% of the workers in the city of Oakland would be impacted by this. Also included is 5 paid sick days, which is also very crucial because speaking for myself personally, when I first began my first day at work, I was actually sick, but I was not in a position to stay at home. And we're talking about a fast food industry to where if people who work there, those who are employed, do not have paid sick days, they are either faced with the option of either A, staying at home and not receiving any money, or B, going to work feeling ill. And we're talking about people who deal with our food, right? So this is a very practical situation here.
That's right. So John is an eBase is a member of the Lift Up Oakland Coalition, which includes workers, community members, faith leaders, and small businesses who have realized that the best way to lift up our city is to put money in the pockets of workers so they can put food on the table, pay their rent. We know that rents in Oakland and the Bay are rising, and take care of themselves and their families. So as John indicated, the policy is for 1225 beginning March of 2015 if it passes on the November ballot, and would include 5 to 9 paid sick days annually for those workers, and that the wage would increase with the cost of living each year.
And this is Marty Bennett, North Bay Jobs with Justin. The UC Berkeley Labor Center just put out a report about the impacts of the proposed citywide ballot initiative. Give us a couple of the main points that that report made.
Sure. So in addition to UC Berkeley's study, Institute for Women's Policy Research also put out a study around paid sick day access at the same time. So I do want to talk a little bit about both of those. As John just mentioned, the Berkeley study estimates that 25 to 30% of Oakland workers, which is about 40 to 48,000 workers, would receive a raise under the Lift Up Oakland initiative so that folks can take care of themselves, right? And as we know, this is just a start. And IWPR's report indicated that about 37% or 57,000 workers in the city of Oakland currently do not have paid sick day access. And so we're putting folks in a position where they're making low wages, not having access to paid sick days, and they're making impossible and critical choices between their health and a paycheck.
And John, could you tell us a little bit about specifically if this citywide minimum wage passes, how's it going to affect you and your family?
Oh, it's going to impact me in huge ways. For example, in the wintertime, I have 2 blankets in my bedroom. I have one on my bed, and I have one that covers the window due to poor window insulation. I really don't have adequate curtains. So in the wintertime, I'm forced between choosing to whether I want to have the blanket up on the window to try to at least keep some heat in, but at the same time, I'm still cold in my bed, or if I put both blankets on me. Now, I might be a little warmer, but when it's time to go out to the restroom, guess what? I'm cold. So we're talking about this is a situation that would help me do buy practical things for the home.
John, what's a security guard at Burger King make? I mean, it doesn't have to be yourself specifically, but what do they pay people there? And what kind of hours do they get? And are there any benefits?
Not enough per hour. $10 an hour. And for that type of work in the area that is at, you're dealing with different demographics. You know, you're dealing with homeless people. You're dealing with those with drug problems. You're dealing with those with mental health problems. So it's very hazardous. And also to consider that when you're dealing with people who themselves don't have access to medical help, they can come in with potentially contagious diseases. And I'm usually the first line of defense. So I'm the first guy at risk, right? No paid sick days whatsoever. You know, I had a coworker who she was feeling ill, but she had to come to work because she needed the money, and kind of find out she was pregnant, and she almost failed. She was woozy and she spun around, and it was fortunate for her that I was in the vicinity. I was able to come over and catch her before she hit the ground. And we're talking about solid brick wall, sharp angles everywhere to where she could have hit herself. She could have potentially been seriously injured.
Both Shamis and John, you know, if we look back in history in Oakland, we can see there was a living wage ordinance passed for the city of Oakland. There was a living wage ordinance passed for the port of Oakland. Then we had this tremendous activity around Occupy. Is there a continuity here between what's gone on in the past and what's happening now with the citywide minimum wage?
Yeah, thanks for making that connection, Marty. So over the past 15 years, as you mentioned, eBase has helped to pass 8 living wage policies across 6 East Bay cities. 3 of those being in Oakland, the city of Oakland, Port of Oakland, and at the Oakland Army Base redevelopment. And this work has been done, just like the work that we're doing now around the minimum wage initiative, has been done in coalition with workers and community members. And these policies tended to be more comprehensive, right? Because the goal is not just to increase the wage, but also to provide benefits that families can use in order to take care of themselves, knowing that it takes more than just a wage to lift yourself out of poverty and be successful in your job. So the living wage policies of the past and the minimum wage policy today today also include paid sick time. We know that the success of these living wage policies has really helped to lay the groundwork for the initiative that we're working on now, and that this minimum wage initiative is one step toward getting to a living wage, which of course is our ultimate goal. And you also mentioned Occupy Oakland, which I think the significance of that movement was really to raise awareness of the growing and extreme income inequality that Paul Son mentioned in the previous segment, and to raise issues of extreme corporate profits and stagnant wages and the struggle of the working class to really make ends meet. So we're seeing living wage policies and minimum wage policies across the country lifting up this issue and solving this problem of the working poor.
So a living wage really is a wage that gets people out of poverty. And the definition of poverty is you don't have enough money to make your meet your basic needs. So you don't get that second blanket, and you don't have, maybe you run out of food at the end of the month, or the kids eat and you don't. But so who opposes this? I mean, why would anyone be opposed to people not living in poverty?
You know, we had over 33,000 registered Oakland voters sign the initiative to get this on the ballot. So not many oppose, right? We know that there's many, many residents, workers, faith leaders in Oakland who want to see folks move out of poverty, get a living wage, be able to take care of themselves and their families. And I don't think anyone's really opposed to the minimum wage, to increasing the minimum wage and moving folks out of poverty. But, you know, there's always debate about how that's done. And we believe that we need to put food on the table and help people pay their rent now. Not 5 years from now, not 2 years from now, but today. As John indicated, folks are struggling today.
We want to come over and talk to Marty a little bit about what's going on in the North Bay. But last year, my students at Sonoma State did a survey of small businesses in Santa Rosa. And what we found is essentially small businesses are paying above minimum wage, that they do take care of their workers, and that it's the fast food chains and the box stores that don't. So that seems to be the political opposition is from these big employers that are trying to get workers as cheap as possible and have them be on food stamps so the government subsidizes them, but they're not paid enough to buy their own food. Marty, tell us what's going on up north.
Well, in the North Bay, there's this myth that this is the wine country and everybody lives in affluence. And you tear that away and you find that almost a third of the families in Sonoma County are the working poor. And their income is no more than $44,000 a year. And as in so much of the Bay Area, Sonoma County is a very high-cost county. And the California Budget Project says a true living wage just for self-sufficiency for a family of four is two parents working full-time. They must each be earning $20 an hour. So we've had a living wage campaign that's gone on over the last decade, and we've passed living wage ordinances in smaller cities like Sonoma, Sebastopol, and Petaluma in 2006. And now we're moving towards a living wage ordinance for the county of Sonoma. As with the city of Oakland, and we've long been inspired by what's gone on in the East Bay, it will cover county workers and workers for county contractors. It will also have 12 paid sick days, but it will be $15 an hour. And we feel this is part of our connection to the national Fight for 15 campaign. Our ordinance will also cover 3,500 in-home support service workers who are making $11.65 an hour, and a bump up to $15 is going to make a huge difference for them.
So, Marty, this is happening nationwide and North Bay, and we're going to talk to San Francisco and the South Bay here after our break, and we're going to keep Jamise and John here in studio with us and kind of have a wrap-up. But we're really talking about improving wages for the lowest income people in the country nationwide, and that this will enhance the economy. It can eliminate poverty if we really did this right. And it just seems like a natural no-brainer to try to make happen. So, Jamise, how do you see this emerging overall in the country in terms of Oakland and what you're doing?
I think the Fight for 15 fast food workers and Walmart workers have really raised public awareness around this issue, right, across the nation. And then here regionally, we're seeing a lot of momentum as we're interviewing and talking with so many cities today. This is really a national fight. We've gotten to the point where income inequality is so extreme that folks are really needing to take these battles to the streets, both in their own cities and nationally, to raise awareness and make changes for themselves. And John, if you want to... jump in here. That's great, too.
John, did you go out on strike when they had the actions here a month or so ago?
I actually didn't, because I wasn't in a position to afford it. That's the sad reality of it, right?
That's the sad reality of it. Yes, exactly. But that was a global effort, right?
Yes, definitely. And I think the greatest aspect of this campaign is the human element. You know, that first of all, it's all about human dignity. Every American has a right to go to work, to come home, put food on the table, and to feel good about him or herself, knowing that they did everything they can to feed their kids, right? As well as other organizations understanding the need to band together around this issue. This isn't just limited to locally or even regionally. This is nationally. People everywhere are recognizing that people need to be paid. It needs to be compensating according to what they're doing.
And I think the big point here is raising the minimum wage at the federal level is going nowhere. The California legislature did raise the minimum to $10 an hour, but that is not a true living wage. And what I think we see happening here in the Bay Area is a regional-wide campaign to raise up labor standards. And we're taking action where the action is not happening at the federal level, or when we're not getting the kind of true living wage that we would like the state legislature to pass.
Omar, do you really think that this is going to be on the Democrats' agenda for this for the next presidential race?
Well, we do have five states where there are going to be ballot initiatives to raise the minimum wage. And many of those states, Massachusetts, Idaho, Alaska, South Dakota, Arkansas, there are contested races in the Senate between Republicans and Democrats. And minimum wage increases at the ballot tends to drive Democratic voters, and particularly low-income people of color, immigrants, etc. The question, I think, is, are the Democrats really willing to take on this issue of growing income inequality? And from our perspective, as Shamis says, it starts in the streets, all right? It starts locally. And that's what's going to bring the pressure upon the Democrats to truly engage this issue of income inequality.
I'm Peter Phillips. My guest host today is Marty Bennett. Our topic is the Fight for the 15 campaign nationally, and we're going to take a short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. We're discussing the Fight for 15 campaign, $15 an hour for every working American, and that's the goal and the idea. So, Marty Bennett is with us here today, and he's with the North Bay Jobs for Justice. Marty, you're going to introduce our next guest.
Our next guest is Gordon Marr. He's executive director of San Francisco Jobs with Justice. Previously, he has served as executive director of the Chinese Progressive Association. And Gordon's been involved in community and labor organizing in San Francisco for over two decades. Welcome, Gordon.
Thanks, Marty.
In the wake of the $15 an hour citywide minimum approved in Seattle, there were two competing ballot initiatives in the city of San Francisco around raising your existing citywide minimum, which I think presently is about $10.60 something an hour. Tell us what's happened in San Francisco, there's only going to be one ballot initiative in the fall to raise the citywide minimum to $15 an hour.
Maybe I'll start with just giving a little bit of a background to the San Francisco context, to the minimum wage debate. In San Francisco, you know, just like in the other cities, there's been pretty intense political struggle over the specifics of the minimum wage measure between pro-business and pro-worker forces. But as you know, San Francisco has a long history of enacting some pretty groundbreaking local labor laws, including our 2003 minimum wage law, which has been the highest in the country up to this point. We also passed the nation's first paid sick leave law in 2006, and also a healthcare security ordinance in 2007, which is sort of a local version of the Affordable Care Act, but with much stronger employer spending mandates for health insurance. So all of these previous groundbreaking labor policy campaigns were led by coalitions of community and labor groups working together. So we were well positioned to try to push the bar further on the minimum wage policy in 2014, you know, especially given the housing and the cost of living crisis in San Francisco. But one challenge that we faced was that the San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee, pretty much out of the blue, late last year announced that he wanted to convene a stakeholder group to develop a proposal to increase the minimum wage in San Francisco and to place a measure on the November 2014 ballot. This was a challenge, you know, because this mayor, who really hasn't done a whole lot, you know, in his tenure to support low-wage workers or working-class communities in the city, was trying to stake out a leadership position on a minimum wage issue. And then he was also convening a stakeholder group that was stacked with employer representatives from the Chamber of Commerce and Golden Gate Restaurant Association to small business groups. So it created a little bit of challenge for our forces, who have had such a good history of moving progressive labor laws here in the city. So what happened was we sort of convened a new coalition, you know, of a lot of the same labor and community groups that had worked on the previous campaigns, and developed a strategy to try to navigate the mayor's process, but really to ensure that a minimum wage measure in San Francisco moves forward that's as strong as possible. So our main strategy was to basically move forward with our own Clean 15 minimum wage measure, which we announced publicly in April. And we launched a signature gathering campaign to place it on the ballot for November. So we did that, you know, while the mayor was still convening his stakeholder group, and really before the mayor or even any of the business groups, you know, had put forward any public minimum wage proposal. Ours was really the first one that was out there, and we were able to get a lot of media coverage of it, even from the mainstream corporate media here in the city. So that kind of put us back, I think, in sort of the forefront of defining what the minimum wage measure should be in the city. And so the mayor was continuing to convene his stakeholder group, which really was a really contentious process, and some of us participated in it. The stakeholder group that the mayor had wasn't really coming to consensus on a measure. So we started to gain more, I think, momentum on our just taking initiative around our own measure. And again, that I think that gave us leverage and allowed us to kind of shape, you know, where the mayor's proposal ended up being. And then that led to some negotiations basically between our coalition and the mayor, and a few members of the Board of Supervisors over the last several weeks, that resulted in a compromise consensus minimum wage measure that is really strong. So it's a $15 minimum wage measure, or stronger than the Seattle measure in many respects, because it gets all workers in San Francisco to $15 an hour in 4 years by 2018, rather than 7 years in Seattle. And then our measure also doesn't include a lot of the big exemptions and carve-outs that were included in the Seattle compromise measure. We only include two very narrowly defined sort of exemptions for youth workers and seniors that are enrolled in specific employment programs. So that consensus measure came together on June 10th, and we view that as a big victory, you know, by our coalition in really kind of being able to shape and set the terms of what forced the mayor and even the Chamber of Commerce to agree to.
We're speaking with Gordon Marr, who's the executive director of San Francisco Jobs with Justice. So in many ways, we can see public opinion shifting. We can see what happened at SeaTac in Seattle. And now San Francisco seems to be building on what happened in Seattle. And really, business, Golden Gate Restaurant Association, because of the street heat, the movement in San Francisco has really been forced to compromise up, if you will, in terms of what came out in the wash with that $15 an hour citywide minimum that'll be on the ballot in the fall. Gordon, I want to ask you, I know San Francisco Jobs with Justice is engaged in other efforts to raise labor standards in San Francisco. And could you talk a little bit about your Retail Workers Bill of Rights and the work that you're doing in the retail industry?
Yeah, Marty, I'd really be happy to. So we, besides moving forward on this really exciting $15 minimum wage measure on the November ballot, Jobs with Justice and their labor and community groups are also going to be moving an equally exciting and groundbreaking Retail Worker Bill of Rights ordinance that we're going to be moving through our Board of Supervisors. And this new ordinance would address a lot of the non-wage problems that are really prevalent, particularly for retail and fast food and other restaurant workers, and that's access to hours and the growing sort of part-time and contingent nature of service work. And we view that equally important problems to address for low-wage workers to really lift them up out of poverty. So in addition to pushing for higher wages, we have to be pushing particularly the big employers to provide more hours and really full-time work and more predictable and stable work schedules for workers. So our Retail Worker Bill of Rights policy, which we're still finalizing the provisions of, you know, are going to include some, like a provision that would address the part-time work problems and promote full-time work for service workers by requiring the retail and fast food employers to offer more hours to existing part-time workers before they hire new part-time workers.
Gordon, we're almost out of time for your segment.
Sure.
I want to ask one quick question, though. How does enforcement happen? I mean, over 140 cities and counties have passed minimum wage, living wage laws around the country, some 30-plus here in California. Who enforces these laws?
That's a great question. In San Francisco, since we've been a little bit ahead of the curve in enacting local labor laws, we've also been able to sort of grapple with the enforcement challenges and come up with some new approaches to that. So I'd say one significant thing that we have in San Francisco is we have a city agency called the Office of Labor Standards Enforcement that is responsible for enforcing our minimum wage and paid sick leave and other local labor laws. So that's been a really positive development just to have a local labor agency that we can work with, because given the lack of funding and even commitment that we see from the state and the federal labor enforcement agencies. We also have an innovative partnership that's been created with our local labor standards enforcement office and community-based organizations and worker centers, where they actually fund worker centers to do proactive outreach to low-wage workers and immigrant workers about their rights and help work in partnership with the city agency.
Gordon,
enforce.
Thank you so much for being involved and keeping us informed of what's happening in San Francisco. This is clearly a national effort, and we appreciate you being on with us.
Thank you.
Okay, and we also want to hear from the South Bay. So, Derica Marins is the Executive Director of Working Partnerships USA down in San Jose, Silicon Valley. It's an innovation laboratory for an inclusive economy. She has more than a decade of community organizing experience with working class communities of color, instrumental in developing, organizing, and campaign strategies to win policies that improve the lives of Silicon Valley workers and families, including the 2002 minimum wage increase in the city of San Jose. Derica, are you with us?
I am. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being on. Tell us what's going on in the South Bay.
Well, I'd love to tell you. And, you know, you mentioned the San Jose minimum wage, and it wasn't 2002, it was 2012. Just want to point that out, but we were very excited to be a part of that. And I think out of the minimum wage effort that was really broad-based down here, we realized that there's got to be an accompanying strategy to raising the floor, raising the minimum wage, to really expanding the middle and looking at how do we not just have a minimum wage workforce, but really get folks out of poverty and into the middle class? And so what we're working on right now is with the County of Santa Clara. The County of Santa Clara is somewhere between usually the second or third largest employer in Silicon Valley. It's got an annual budget of about $5 billion a year, and it procures about $2.5 billion a year in goods and services. That's a pretty major influencer of the regional economy down here. And the question before the Board of Supervisors is, how can it assert its influence in the economy to impact the lives of working people? And so we're moving with Supervisor Ken Yeager and Supervisor Dave Cortese, our two champions on the board, exploring an ordinance to provide a living wage, what we're calling a cutting-edge living wage, that really gets at the changing nature of work in Silicon Valley, that's really more than wages and healthcare even. It's about a package of provisions that make a quality job.
Derica, could you take that one step further and tell us more about the different provisions in this living wage ordinance that would really extend down into the supply chain for the county where there's so many lousy part-time temp jobs?
You got it. Yeah, you got it. So we kind of look at this policy as broken into four sets of issues that correspond to the nature of work and that get at sort of the low-road supply chain employers that you're talking about. The first is fair compensation and health care, and that is about the wage. And the wage rate we're looking at is the San Jose living wage rate, which is about $17 an hour if you don't provide health insurance to your workers, just over $15, almost $16 an hour if you do. It's also about provisions like earned sick leave for a worker who's sick or to care for a family member who's sick. The second provision is about equal opportunity and access to quality jobs. It's really opening the door for workers. So it's about ban the box policies to allow workers to have equal access to apply for a job and be available for a job. It's about targeted hire, sort of how do you get disadvantaged workers into a quality job, and local hire. How do we make sure that we're hiring locally as opposed to contributing to greenhouse gas emissions and other things by bringing workers in to the region? The third area is around the opportunity for full-time and predictable work. And this is a really big one, especially for some of the low-road supply chain service providers that we see. So this is really the fact that as the nature of work has changed over the last few decades, we see more part-time work, we see contingent work and temp work being the way that folks make a living these days. And so these provisions are going to say to the county subcontractors, if you want to have additional hours on your contract, you need to offer those hours to part-time workers before you can hire a full-time worker. And it's also saying that you need to offer folks some predictability in their schedule. I mean, a mom of two kids who needs childcare can't have her schedule come out the Saturday before the week. How does she arrange childcare? How does she make sure her kids can get to and from school, et cetera? And then the last is really about giving workers a voice at work, and that's making sure that workers who want to organize on the job, they have the anti-retaliation protection that they need, and that labor piece is a part of the scenario. So those are the provisions.
That's really an inspiration for us in the North Bay. And I did want to highlight one point and ask your opinion on this, because I believe the Chamber of Commerce in San Jose spent hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to defeat the citywide minimum wage that raised the citywide minimum to $10 an hour in the fall of 2012. Do you anticipate that kind of opposition from the business community to your proposed cutting-edge living wage ordinance?
We do, and yeah, they spent almost $1 million against us. We do anticipate it. I mean, right now we're already getting signals that in the back door, this is a little different in that it's not a ballot initiative campaign, so we don't know what they're spending, but we know they've started to talk, both to legislators and others. While we're studying the issue, they have not publicly come out against us. But they're starting to send hints that this is something that they're going to be very vocal about as it moves from studying an ordinance to enacting an ordinance. So I think we're going to see that. We're just not going to know what they spend in the same way that you do when you have a valid initiative.
Derica, hi, this is Peter Phillips.
Who puts up $1 million to fight keeping people out of poverty? I mean, is this coming from the big chains? I'm sometimes mystified by this.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, it's not Rudolph and Mary's trophy shop that we're dealing with here. Mm-hmm. But they will say, oh, we're trying to protect the small business, which is the phase-in thing, you know, 7 years to get it to the level you want, that sort of thing. Really, who are we fighting here?
You know, it remains to be seen for us. In 2012, let's see, the minimum wage was a threat to the Restaurant Association primarily. And so as our friends at the Restaurant Opportunity Center, a fabulous national worker center that organizes restaurant workers, likes to say, it's the other NRA, right, the National Restaurant Association, put in lots of the chamber money here. The county contract system is very complex. Remember, a county runs the health and hospital system. It runs the jails and the juvenile justice system and the social service system. That takes care of poor people in the county, right? And so the contracts that we're digging into as we're studying this ordinance are actually pretty profound in terms of how it might impact folks. Everything from, you know, a $36 million contract for emergency physicians, which might mean a bunch of health aides are in there that are going to get a lift up. It also might mean the healthcare industry starts to look at this and say, oh my God, what is our position? And so we don't exactly know yet, but we do know that just looking at the dollars that are spent, that we're anticipating a surge of opposition.
Derek, I want to thank you very much. And if you can stay on the line, we'll move towards a kind of a regional discussion. Two things I want to highlight. And really, when we look at this massive problem of income inequality, it is one struggle and many fronts. And living wage, citywide minimum wage, that's one approach. But we have to be working on multiple approaches simultaneously. And I want to just highlight two things that are happening in Sonoma County. First, as Derek alluded to, workers have no rights in this country. They do not have the right to organize. And how, at the local level, can we protect workers' rights to organize and join unions? Because really, it's only the massive unionization of the low-wage service sector which is going to lift people into the middle class. And so in Sonoma County right now, there is a new casino that opened in Rohnert Park. And Unite Here Local 2850 has an agreement with the Federated Indians of the Grayton Rancheria and the operator of the casino, Stations Casino, to organize the workers in that casino free from interference by the employer. And just over the last several days, 600 workers have been engaged to sign cards indicating their preference for union representation. And a majority of these workers signed cards. The company will recognize the union. In another month or two, 400 workers in restaurants are also going to be signing cards. And when this facility is unionized, over 1,200 workers, these are going to be some of the best service sectors jobs in the community, union jobs that pay living wages, that have comprehensive health and retirement benefits. Now, the second thing that's happening, and interestingly, this is in Rohnert Park again, and it's not far from the new casino that has opened in Rohnert Park. And that is, there's a Walmart discount store that Walmart has wanted to expand that discount store to become a super center. North Bay Jobs with Justice has been engaged in a 5-year campaign to block that proposal from going forward. We've turned out hundreds to city council meetings. We've canvassed the entire community, gathered thousands of signatures against that super center. And a lawsuit by two environmental organizations in our coalition stopped that Walmart super center proposal in 2010. But as always, Walmart is back. They have a revised EIR that they want to move through the Rohnert Park City Council, and it could be as early as late July. We want to have a massive Bay Area-wide campaign to stop the low road, we call it, to prevent these bad jobs from coming to our communities. And I think that this is going on across the Bay Area when we talk about one struggle, many fronts of income inequality, addressing that problem. And I just want the participants on the show to weigh in on how can we collaborate regionally.
maybe we should remind everybody who we are. Of course, Marty's from the North Bay. Jamie's here from Oakland, and John from Oakland, and Doris is the South Bay. And your big question is, how are we going to make all this happen? Dorica, what do you say to that?
So that is the question, and I guess I would say, here's the good news. Some of that is already happening, I think, right? Jamise works for the East Bay Alliance for a Sustainable Economy. They, along with Working Partnerships, where I work, we're part of a national network of organizations that works with folks like Jobs with Justice nationally, and we're all sort of in this moment, this post-Occupy, let's quote-unquote come out of this recession with a new invigorated organizing culture, really talking about what does this movement look like to scale. And, you know, it's no joke or no accident that we passed minimum wage in 2012. In 2012, Long Beach passed the first ever hotel living wage on an industry. And then Obama is talking minimum wage. And now all of a sudden in cities across the state, you know, there are ordinances and there are ballot initiatives moving. And that's because we're starting to wake up to the need to coordinate and get organized, I think.
That's right. Thanks, Derica. Hey, this is Jamise. And I would just, you know, echo exactly what you're saying. We have been collaborating for a long time and continue to collaborate. You know, Gordon mentioned the SF $15 an hour ballot initiative, which gets to $12.25 at the same time that Oakland would get to $12.25 in 2015, right? So we're talking about creating a regional coordination. And many of the coalition partners that we have in Lift Up Oakland are coalition partners in other Bay Area fights. Marty mentioned Unite Here 2850, who's also part of Lift Up Coalition. Derica mentioned Restaurant Opportunity Center, who's also part of Lift Up. So there really are coalition partners and players that are operating all across the city, all across the region to ensure coordination.
I think it's really an important issue here. And to put it in the context, I mean, this is a Bay Area. You're all working together. We've heard from different voices all across the Bay. But this is a national issue in scope. But certainly the Bay Area needs to be taking a major lead in this. It's one of the most expensive places to live in the world. Between rents and food and everything and gas, it's just quite a difficult way to make ends meet. And you come up short many times, particularly on these low-wage jobs. So that's a very important piece of what we're talking about here, I think. John, what is your hopes here?
First of all, once we begin to understand who are truly impacted by this, because I think a lot of times when people think about minimum wage workers, for some strange reason, they think of teenagers, high school students. For example, in Oakland, after research that came out, the median age of an impacted worker was 32 years old. So we're talking about folks who are forced to work minimum wage jobs, right, that strip them of the dignity that they deserve as parents. This is our opportunity to put a human face to a horrible problem. That's basically what this is about, a message of hope. That's what I like to see, to continue this message of hope to people who are affected by this situation and to have the respective organizations who are involved to continue to organize, to continue to educate, to continue to communicate around these issues.
Well, I want to thank all of our participants. I think this is a fascinating discussion, which needs to be an ongoing discussion. And I really think we may be in an extraordinary moment in history, given what's happened with Seattle and now San Francisco, and now taking place all across California. So we look forward to investigating further this kind of collaboration and lifting up the wage floor from below.
We're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest, and Erica Bridgman on the controls. The Project Censored Show airs on over a dozen stations around the U.S. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow us and like us on Facebook. Thanks very much to Marty Bennett for co-hosting with me today.
Political ties, habitual lies, alibis, skies, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by taxes while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the ties for the master thief. Divine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we flip our brothers and our sisters.